You want me to start?
Yeah, I want you to start.
All right, I guess it's time to get started. I've been told by the powers that be, Paul, that we're ready to go, or should be. We're not. I'm Viva Moffitt. I'm a professor at the University of Denver Law School, and I want to thank Paul and the Silicon Flatirons organization for having me up here and putting together such a great panel. And I think what Paul said about 2010 being a great year for privacy, or maybe a terrible year for privacy, he could have been even more precise, and that this week is sort of an unbelievable week to have pulled together a privacy and the press and scoops and ethics conference, and so I want to congratulate you on that. This panel is about unmasking, or as Jeffrey Rosen put it, piercing anonymity, we'll talk about, I think, when and under what circumstances we might want to do that. Which allows us to talk, I think, about all three of the things that Jeffrey Rosen raised earlier: law, norms, and technology. And I think this is really a place where we have to talk about all three of them, and where the fight between free speech on the one hand and privacy on the other hand maybe comes to its most pointed moment, or some of the most difficult questions about that conflict arise in thinking about anonymity and undermining or piercing anonymity on the line, online. So we have a great panel here. First, James Grimmelman is going to present a paper. James is a professor, associate professor of law at New York Law School. And then three discussants. Evan Brown is a graduate of the University of Denver Law School, I have to point out first. He is also an attorney practicing at Hinshaw & Culbertson in Chicago. He does technology and intellectual property and is a blogger, so we can refer also blogger questions to him, I think, at internetcases.com. And he represents clients using and developing social media. And next, Danielle Citrin is a professor at the University of Maryland Law School who has written widely on cyber civil rights and this question about anonymity or lack thereof online. And finally, we have Nathaniel Gleischer, that's embarrassing, who is at the Department of Justice in the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section of the Criminal Division. So we're going to have a paper presentation first and then comments and discussion, and I hope Q&A from the audience as well. James, you ready?
What?
So I want to talk about one technological distinction that I think might be helpful in talking about a lot of issues of privacy and anonymity in technology. And what I want to frame this is to put up here a tweet by Ryan Kahlo about this paper. So it's sort of a circular kind of discussion here. But you'll notice that he's tweeted that there are privacy and innovation thought pieces by Helen Nissenbaum, Frank Pasquale, at Grimmelm, and others up online. And what's interesting there is that Frank Pasquale and Helen Nissenbaum's name are just like text, like anything else in that tweet. Whereas when he wrote at Grimmelm, it got turned into a red hyperlink. If you click on that on the web, it takes you to my page on Twitter. And this is going to explore the difference between representing people in a computer system where they're just text and turning them into what I'm going to call first-class objects. So it's the distinction between James Grimmelman and at Grimmelm. Now, the words James Grimmelman depend upon a community of readers to figure out what they mean. Twitter has no idea. It could be that's no different from the weather is nice today. It has no semantic content to Twitter. Whereas at Grimmelm is something that Twitter recognizes and knows what to do with. It says, that's a username. I'm going to turn that into a hyperlink. And that's linked to all kinds of information about me. My tweets, my followers, my password changes. So when you click on that link, it goes to this page which has a picture of me. It has an ordered list of the things that I've tweeted with the times. It has lots of information. So the system can do things like compute lists and reason about me and what I've done on the system. So one way of thinking about this is that it's building up this block. James Gwimmelman is a single thing that Twitter recognizes, rather than just being a random assemblage of one character after another, a J, then an A, then an M, and so on. And what it does is it takes, when it sees these things all together, it turns it into a unique identifier for me. It has a large database with lots of records and entries in it, and it creates one specially for me. I'm there, it has a list of my tweets, it has all this information, and this is all keyed off of some long number inside Twitter's system that is unique and special to me. So I want to spend most of my time talking about the consequences that follow. What makes the world different when Twitter and Facebook and credit reporting agencies and lots of other places have databases that have unique identifiers for people and entries just about them? So the first, and so easy it's easy to overlook it, is that there's a third party in this system at all. If somebody says James Gwimmelman to you, that person, you may or may not know who I am, but you can figure that out on your own. @Gwimmelm is only meaningful in the context of Twitter. If Twitter crashes and goes away, it loses any special meaning. It becomes just another name, loose and unstructured, like it. Whereas this structured data, @Gwimmelm and all of the information it has, only makes sense in the context of the system that carries out the mapping. This has a lock-in effect in practice. This is why it's very hard to take your context network off of Facebook and go someplace else. But it also makes us vulnerable to third-party manipulation. Twitter could delete me and just destroy my identity if it wanted to. Facebook can draw a mustache on me. Credit reporting agencies could destroy my credit if they wanted to. We become dependent on them. Second thing is it turns this very fuzzy, loose process of natural language into a very precise, computerized, precise one-on-one mapping. All of those things on the left are names that if you shouted them or wrote them, I might think to look around, you said them. Whereas @Gwimmelm is a one distinct, precise name for it. Misspell it slightly, it won't be recognized. But in the same way, it can be linked, guaranteed to me. Whereas think about all the ambiguity in just saying James. Having that unique canonical identifier means we can then pull together lots of data from different sources. You can aggregate information from all over the place. If you realize that this guy is the same as that guy, you can combine the medical records and the work history and the tweets and the Facebook postings and voting history and political donations and all of that and put it together in one larger database. So this means that personal data tends to stick to these identifiers the way that cat hair sticks to sweaters. It's just naturally attracted to it. Having these unique identifiers also means that we can walk through and find every place that they're mentioned. I am quite confident that I could not find all of the places on the internet that discuss me. Between the misspellings of my name, people who confuse me with somebody else, and other things like that, I could not possibly find them all. I can be completely confident that I could find every tweet that mentions me using the @Gwimmelm format. I can enumerate them all and be certain that I've seen the whole list. And for privacy purposes, this could be a net positive, because if there's something embarrassing about me, something I don't want getting out, then I've got a Pokemon problem. In order to stop this bad thing from getting out, I have to catch them all, because even one reference that gets through will mean it's now circulating in public. With enumerability, I can just be watching Twitter in real time, and as soon as somebody tweets about me, I know it. Facebook actually uses this to let you monitor what other people are saying about you in photos. And this can have an empowering effect, because with this identifier, I can then potentially have access to and control the information about me. The common example here is medical records. It's really good to have a single medical record that I can then send to the doctor who's about to give me treatment. Having that in a format that I can control and assimilate is great. more socially, it also lets me participate in self-presentation, that I can have, or Frank can have, a profile that contains exactly those facets that one wants to display. So this is, I think, one of the big attractions of Facebook, is that this object that represents you, you can control the different attributes of and make some of them visible and some of them not. And the Diaspora project, for example, was designed to let you do that by splitting the personality into different profiles, displaying only some facets of them to certain people and some to others. At the heart of that is the idea that there is this unique identifier for you and that you are toggling on and off certain things in that list. Starting to turn towards the darker side, though, there's also an issue in that these things decay differently than analog old-fashioned identifiers. You can imagine a small sequence of errors over a time gradually corrupting my name into something else. It's the equivalent of transcription errors in medieval manuscripts that monks are copying out. Whereas, I can pretty much guarantee you that my identifier with Twitter will be stable and will suffer from no decay. It's a digital medium. It just continues on perfectly until the catastrophic moment when the whole system crashes unrecoverably, and then it's all gone. So these digital media with digital identifiers decay less quickly in normal circumstances, but are more vulnerable to catastrophic failure. And I've already alluded to this, but having these identifiers enables automatic reasoning. That Foursquare, for example, can take different people's check-ins and say, well, if I'm here and you're here and they're all here, we can send messages to all the people that they are in the same place at the same time. Or Facebook can recommend friends to me or recommend products. It's not my friends like. This is automatic reasoning about me on the basis of other information that it can connect to me by going through the network. And this causes us to be more visible. It makes more information on us accessible to others. All you need is a few pieces of information to get started, and you can make huge amounts of stalking and profiling possible. And I go back to Eric Schmidt's suggestion, we should all just change our names when we graduate from high school. So that sounds like it works, until you realize that it only takes one database to identify everybody's high school name and their post-high school name, and congratulations, you've ruined all of the privacy in that system. Just one piece of data unlocks the whole thing. And knowledge is power. Governments have known this. You know, Richelieu's database files on people were early databases. The Census Bureau does it as a form of demography to keep track of populations. There's a real fear here of manipulation of people, even killing them, based upon the personal characteristics that you can glean from finding them in databases like this. And this leads, I think, to the ultimate objection against all of this, which is a kind of degradation in being represented at all. The 1960s student protests at Berkeley used the punch card as a symbol of the machine, both in a very literal data processing sense and in a more abstract, the system, the man, the government sense. Because the feeling is that to be reduced to an entry in a database is a reduction of your humanity to a set of numbers. So this is why I call this use of unique identifiers to represent people in databases first-class objects. That's a term from computer science. It describes the things that a system knows about directly. That there are some things that it has as objects in the system. There are people on Facebook. They're central to it. And other things that can be described only indirectly. Those are second class or higher order. Well, we're first class objects in all of these systems. We're first class. We're central to what they're about. They're about us. We are important. We are valued. But we are also objects reduced to what the database can represent about us, and in that sense, quite literally, objectified. So I want to finish by teeing up and not answering in the slightest three questions that I think this raises that might be relevant to our themes today. The first is whether people who make and operate these databases have higher, more stringent obligations towards people when the people are represented in their databases as first-class objects. That is, Should Facebook have stronger duties towards people whom it has information on than Google does, precisely because Facebook has information about them in this object-oriented form, whereas in Google it's typically just in large streams of unformatted text? Second question is whether storing in databases leads to us to think about unmasking differently than one-off individual storage. Should we approach the unmasking problem with different glasses on, depending on whether we're asking about an identity in a database? Tell us who user 673215 is, or whether we're asking an individual, like a journalist, tell us who your source, Mr. Blue, is. And then finally, the existence of these databases, all of these sources that are keyed off of these few unique identifiers. Does this change how we should think about what it means for a person or for a journalist to go and do investigations and profile somebody else? Does this change the balance of power between being known and hiding in a way that we should care about collectively? All right, thank you, and let's get on to the conversation.
All right, thanks, James. And I fear we're going to have more questions than answers on this panel. And I think Danielle is going to go first, and she's promised more questions than answers.
Yeah, so forgive me, right, for having more questions. So, you know, there are, of course, that's James has a terrific paper, and there are really some incredibly important implications of the work he's doing here. And thinking about the extraordinary amount of sensitive and then otherwise information in the hands of third parties. And so, on the one hand, what it could mean is that those who do mischief online, you know, harass, defame, invade privacy, they may be less anonymous. That is, if all this information is about them online, then maybe the dream of the semantic web is that they'll be held accountable. But I think it's probably more true, though, that what's really going on is that victims of those mischief makers are ever more vulnerable, that more information is going to be collected about them online and revealed, and that, while at the same time, defendants can, of course, use tools to hide themselves. And so the balance of power, in some sense, is shifting further in the direction of defendants or mischief makers versus and creating more vulnerabilities for victims. And so I think that leads to questions about, do we need to do something in law or even social norms to address this problem, right? And so James, in a prior paper, there are a couple of possibilities that we might, if they sound interesting to you all, we might talk about. One is the, as James calls it, the unmasking option, that in lieu of litigation, we might think about unmasking defendants as the remedy under certain circumstances. So that's one possibility. Another is to rethink the very broad immunity that we provide those who host, index, and carry content online in a way that sort of mimics the notice and takedown, but would rather be afford immunity to those hosting content if, when they're given notice of defamation, privacy invasions, harassment, that they retain identifying information about those accused of posting, so that we can bring some accountability into this space. It's not a guarantee, right? Defendants can, of course, use anonymizing tools, but it's a way to get at the perpetrators who are the real, you know, if we want to bring law to bear, we want to bring it on the perpetrators. So that's another possibility. A third is to provide legal incentives for victims to sue. Today, especially in harassment suits and privacy suits, victims often do not want to sue under their own names, right? They want to sue as Jane or John Doe's because to sue in their own names is almost to exacerbate the privacy problem. And it's also true that victims might also want to sue their defendants as John or Jane Doe's because to identify their attackers is to really identify them if they have a close relationship with their attackers. And some victims have made requests, of course, in many jurisdictions and have been denied. And we might want to think about relaxing rules, at least in the courtroom, so that we can vindicate legal rights while at the same time encouraging victims to come forward. And the last possibility is, and I've heard this from victims groups, is to think about creating sites that name and shame websites that refuse to take down defamatory, harassing, or privacy-invasive content. And on the one hand, it seems like a good idea, but because what we're doing is going to be shaming those sites. But on the other hand, and if I don't know if you guys saw in the Sunday Times, the business section, that negative posts actually raise the Google ranks, right, of these sites, and so they'll get more traffic. So in some sense, I think it's a weak alternative, but I thought I'd throw it out for us to think about. So those are the questions that I'm raising. I know I'm not answering them, but I thought at least could start us in some conversation. Evan,
you want to go ahead?
Sure. James raises some really interesting issues in this paper and in this presentations, in this presentation about some essential notions of the semantic web, which you mentioned, Danielle, which is this promise that we have about the, you know, the next iteration of the web, what it's going to look like, data being smarter, you know, having data structured and encoded in such a way that it's easier to use and it's more beneficial for us when we're going out there looking for information, trying to develop things. And, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the semantic web and the notions underlying it, not just from the legal perspective, which is, you know, the thinking about things from a legal perspective is, of course, what I get paid to do every day as a practicing attorney, but it's also very interesting to think of this from a very philosophical perspective when we get down to the semantic layer, or that point of how it is that meaning is assigned to data and how it's encoded so that it takes on something magical, so to speak. It's unstructured at one point or in one state, but then something magic happens, a dollop of something comes and touches this data, and then it's has semantic import. And one thing that I've really been struck by in James's work on this is his assertion that encoding data and using Twitter as an example here makes it so that the system can reason. I mean, that's a really that's a really amazing thing to think of. I can't even think of the word, because that there is something really transcendent or metaphysical that's going to happen from the point of not being able to reason when it becomes then, reasonable is not the right word, but prone to reason or something like that. Who knows? It may be reasonable. So James's first question, which I'm glad I wrote down, because and James again said he's not going to answer any of this, but when he says that there is that the question for us to consider, is there a higher obligation when a service provider or a platform will treat objects in the database as first-class objects? Is there a heightened duty that's triggered? Have I characterized the question?
Yeah, thinking about people.
Okay, good. So the data that is in the database is merely a representation of a person existing in the real world. I would have had a hard time joining in those protests in the 1960s because I, think most other people, have a bit higher self-esteem than to think that we are just the punch card data or something like that. We exist here, independent of anything that there is out there. So to present the question as to whether there should be a higher obligation imposed on the platform provider, the system provider here, at least intimates or suggests that there is a point at which there has to be a meaning assigned to this data whereby we can reason upon it. And in my mind, that is very difficult to pin down. And if we're going to take on the task of finding this point where a new legal obligation is triggered, namely to treat first-class objects as something different than other things, we need to define that. We need to develop some framework so that we can think of it in pragmatic terms and so that the courts can deal with it and determine, if we're going to send this off to the legislature, heaven forbid. We've got to know where that meaning comes from. And I just philosophically, metaphysically, cannot comprehend where that is. Because, and Professor Ohm, you talked about something about this morning, about data, I forget exactly how you couched it, but you raised the question of whether an inquiry along these lines is examining whether there is a distinction in kind or a distinction in magnitude. And I don't know how to place the point where data, because of its structure, makes a system capable of reasoning where that actually happens. It just seems to me like it's a sliding scale. All data really is just taking bits of information randomly out there and putting them together so that they represent something in the real world. You know, Ryan Kahlo's tweet with the real names versus your names, I mean, that's essentially data, and it's just the way it's arranged in a certain way gives it certain attributes, but it still takes the human to have the meaning. Certain things can be done with it, but it still requires human consciousness in order for that reasoning to come about. So there's my question for this. Where is the point at which the magic happens, where we can switch over from thinking data as unstructured and less meaningful so that it becomes meaningful and subject to this higher duty that James intimates may be called for in this analysis?
Nathaniel,
you
want to go ahead?
Sure. I should start by saying I sort of have to put the disclaimer in front. I'm here under my own recognizance, we could say, and nothing that I say is the opinion or the stance of the Department of Justice. This is all my own thoughts and beliefs. James's paper is, it's an interesting topic, and it's excellent for a lot of reasons, but one of the things that I think is most interesting is that it highlights in a very specific way an underpinning problem for a lot of what we're talking about here. Mostly what we're talking about is the ability of third parties to get access to personal information or identifying information about individuals. And when you think about what stands in the way, what are the bars in the way of accessing this information, one key factor has always been friction, by which I mean just the physical difficulty involved with getting access to the data. And here I like to jokingly say that the internet is technological lubricant. And I say that in part because it makes people laugh a little bit or feel a little uncomfortable, but also because it's accurate. What it does is it reduces friction. And every time that questions of privacy have come up, they're paired with a moment of technological innovation because technology has reduced this friction in some meaningful way. The Brandeis article that was talked about earlier comes up in the context of easily portable film and pictures and things. And James is talking about sort of, it's another reduction in friction, and it's a significant reduction in friction. And this friction is built into the degree to which we protect information online and the degree to which we make it difficult for third parties to access information. And so there's always been some legal barrier, right? If Google wants to gather information about someone or a government wants to gather information about someone, there's always been a legal barrier preventing them. But there's also a cost barrier. It's very expensive to hire someone to follow you around and gather this information. And as technology makes the cost less, as it reduces the friction, it reduces the sum total barriers in the way of accessing the information. So as technology develops, even if legal protections remain constant, the ability of third parties to access this information, the ability of third parties to unmask people becomes easier. The barriers in front of them become less. Now that doesn't necessarily mean, and I don't mean to say that that's always a problem. There may be times when you evaluate the situation and you look at the risks that are taking place today, and maybe sometimes you want it to be easier to unmask people. Maybe sometimes you don't. But in order to make that evaluation, you have to separate out the legal barriers and the friction and the reduction in friction that the technology has created and recognize that sometimes, even if the law remains the same, even if the legal barriers remain consistent, the ability to access it changes significantly. And so if you're not taking that into account in the debate, you're sort of missing a very central moving part in the question of how much protection there is and how much accessibility there is to this data. And so one of James's questions was this idea about, is there a difference when we're trying to access an anonymous person who's a potentially anonymous person who's in a database as opposed to who isn't? I mean, in one very real sense, there is a difference because the friction is reduced. It's easier. If you can get access to the structured data, it is much easier to find and to follow the trail of their identity through all of these breadcrumbs that we leave online. What I just wanted to do is to sort of highlight the importance of friction and the importance of the role of technology in reducing it, as we have this discussion, and I suppose to actually answer, or at least give my answer to one of the questions that James raised.
And so why don't you, can you flesh out a little bit your answer, the question that you're answering and what your answer is?
Sure. I mean, so one of the questions that James mentioned was this idea of, is there a difference when information is in, and is there a legal difference or a difference in the question of access if information about a person is stored in a structured format in a database as opposed to, and I believe your example was, in the mind of a journalist as an anonymous source? And, I mean, one of the differences there is that is this change in friction, is that it's more accessible, and it's accessible by more people, right? If you're an anonymous source, if I know who it is, there is a limited set of ways in which someone could find that out, basically by asking me if I could tell them, or by following certain non-structured social clues. But as those clues become more structured, and as the information is in a database, it's accessible and it's subject to access in a wider range of ways.
I think that raises an important point, I'm going to tie together your thoughts and Danielle's, that technology here is acting in some sense neutrally across all kinds of domains we care about. And the unmasking problem is now, if the databases are out there, we're asking questions that we probably would have thought about as, well, finding an anonymous stalker and journalists' anonymous sources. Those are, they're anonymity, but they're very different. Mm-hmm. But now it could be the same intermediary you go to get the information from. And if you have blanket rules for that intermediary, you may get the rule wrong for one of your two cases.
And it's also the case that, I mean, reduction in friction isn't always bad. In fact, it's often very good. And one reaction to this could be, well, let's try to artificially increase the friction, make it harder to get access to these things. And the other thing that was interesting about James' presentation is he also highlighted a lot of places where this reduced friction is good. And so responding to it by simply increasing the friction and making it harder to access it has a lot of collateral impact on access to information in positive ways.
I think this goes a lot back to what Jeffrey Rosen was talking about in his address this morning.
Absolutely.
When talking about Victor Meyer Schoenberger's expiring data proposal. That's a way of increasing friction for old information to make it harder for people to use it against us. And it also has the problems that makes it harder to have your archive of your own memory, which is one of the things where lower friction is great, that I can go back and remember what it felt like back in college when I wrote that really embarrassing email.
Something most of us might like to forget, huh?
It makes me feel like better of me now. It's like, I've come so far since then.
And I think that's why context is so important, right? And be, as James says, and be able to distinguish between the stalker, anonymous or pseudonymous stalker, and the source, the journalist source, and the kind of stakes and the harm that's at issue. I think that's at sort of the root of so many of the problems that we have to face, is we have to say, okay, it's contextual, and we have to apply a set of legal tools and norms that meet those situations. What's interesting is Nathaniel's written, if it's okay, I bring it up, a terrific piece in the Yale Law Journal about John Doe subpoenas and the kinds of rules that we have for unmasking. And I know you expressed at the time a little dissatisfaction in the way in which we were approaching John Doe subpoenas. How do you take the sort of state of affairs today, sort of this sort of summary judgment standard for unmasking,
right,
and is it sufficient to deal with the source for the journalist and at the same time contextually manage in a nimble way the anonymous harasser?
Well, I mean, those are two very different contexts, and they're different for, newsworthiness among a whole wide range of other issues. One thing I think that has changed for me is I'm increasingly suspicious about the effectiveness of the John Doe subpoena standard and the model for it. When I wrote the piece, came out in 2008, and I was sort of defending John Doe subpoenas and trying to figure out a good standard through which you could thread this needle. And I guess I'm increasingly curious or uncertain as to how effective the system is at base, because what happens if you look at large cases involving unmasking a large number of defendants, what you tend to see is that the people who are unmasked are not necessarily the worst offenders. In fact, again, I should mention I'm talking about civil cases here. These are civil contexts. The people who are unmasked in a lot of cases are not the worst offenders. There's it's more the people who are least savvy at anonymizing themselves. And it sends a very complex message when, because you talk about deterrence and the effectiveness of preventing these preventing more people from taking online harassing actions, and you're either deterring them by saying, be careful, you might get unmasked, but potentially what you're also saying is, well, if you're going to anonymously harass someone, you better make sure you're completely anonymous, and here's how you can do it. So I don't have an answer. This, I suppose, is another question that I don't have an answer to, but I wonder what the pressures that this is creating, I'm not sure how effective it's being.
Right. You're protecting, you're ultimately, you're not really protecting victims so much, you're just exposing the least offensive objectors, the mischief makers, leaving the most egregious, you know, defendants to mask themselves because they're smart enough. I mean, I don't know if that's always the case, right?
It's certainly not always the case, but I think that it doesn't even map onto worst or most egregious. It maps onto most or least technically savvy.
Right.
So it's sort of a whole different scale.
Right.
I honestly had never thought of that notion of kind of pushing the harassers or the defamers, you know, the defendants further underground. But I mean, I'm led to wonder why that should be treated to any special, you know, considerations in the digital context. I mean, it's harder to catch a murderer who is savvy and plans where he's going to hide the weapon before he commits the murder than it is somebody who kills in the rage of the moment and has blood on his hands. I mean, is there any meaningful reason to think that the law should treat it the same or differently because of that? Less of ability to deter.
There actually is a sense in which we do treat the murderers differently, because you could go from second-degree murder to first-degree murder for the premeditation, and you could also get a sentencing enhancement for your efforts to try and hide the crime.
But there's nothing in the law that provides making it easier to find somebody who has only committed manslaughter or second-degree versus somebody who's committed murder. That's all done after you actually track the guy down and bring him to court.
Yeah. You just want to make him regret having tried to hide.
Well, maybe does that apply here? Yeah.
But, so I'm interested in the. So we've talked a lot about technology, I think, and the ways in which technology has changed. And this is a perennial problem, it seems to me. And then the next question is how or should, you know, whether and in what way the law should respond. And I think this one question is interesting here. Is well, what. We may want to use the law for its expressive purposes, and Danielle has written about that, to say, well, you know, we don't like it when people harass people online or otherwise, so maybe the law should do something about that, but then does that also have some unintended consequence of creating better harassers in some horrible way, more effective? And so when we have this, if we talk about the technology creating less friction, or the technology, as James says, turning people into these first-class objects, and so how should the law respond? Now I'm going to ask you to answer some of these questions. So should we change Section 230? You know, that's another perennial question. And so I don't know if, James, you want to take a crack at answering any of your questions?
Well, I'll come back to your question about 230, which is that not even speaking prescriptively, but just descriptively, it does not feel stable to me, which is, it's partly that we get some of the more outrageous examples in the last few years, but I think we're also starting to get to situations where you have the people who have set up systems that are designed to facilitate lots of, it's a juicy campus phenomenon, and you get a defense, somebody like that who gets out of the case quickly, and the moral intuitions I think a lot of people have about why 230 belongs there just are under real strain. And Joel Weidenberg who said, you know, as soon as there's a senator's daughter who's the target of one of these, we can kiss 230 goodbye. And the question is whether the policy...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Oh.
People
don't
know.
You
expect
230.
I'm so sorry. Danielle,
you want to do this? Sure.
Danielle should do it. It's my fault. No, I raised it first, right? So I was thinking that as I was saying that I should... sort of educated for folks who don't know it, but Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act says that those who host other or carry or index other people's content are essentially immune from liability. There's some small exceptions, but immune from liability for the, let's say, defamation, you know, for all sorts of civil wrongs, they're immune from the liability created by others. And so that, what James is saying is that, so you feel like post WikiLeaks, that there'll be an uproar, or maybe is, right?
It's going to be something, and somebody's going to come along and say, this is ridiculous, we've got to get rid of this, we need to hold these bad intermediaries liable for all of the defamation and invasion of privacy and other and the lies flung through their systems. And for those of us who think that 230 has some valuable roles to play, I think one of the questions is, how do we articulate a defensible fallback point when the current form, when the current version of it comes under more assault than it can weather?
You know, Paul had a question, right?
No, that was it. I was asking you guys to describe 230.
Thanks for doing that, because I was confused. It's only quarter till, it's 1:45. It's not 1:30.
Well, and so maybe the question arising out of that, and more to be more specific, is 230, Section 230 draws this line between people who host content, roughly speaking, and those who create online content, and provides pretty broad immunity to those who host other content of other people. And so would some of the technology points that have been raised lead to, and this is all refers really to third-party liability, intermediary liability, not the liability of the bad actor, the mischief maker online. And so would some of the changes in technology lead to a way to draw a different line? That is, a line that's different than hosting versus creating content. I mean, and I think some of your work, James, maybe, and your talk today leads in that direction, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, one thing one could say might be that 230 has this nexus of justifications for it, and they overlap a lot. One of them is a sense that it's just unfair to ask intermediaries to do this monitoring because they can't know in a human way everything that passes through their system because there's too much passing through. That is, you certainly couldn't expect Google's employees to individually look at every search and look at the results. That's just impossible. There's a second way on that, which is that they can't reasonably make judgments about what should come through or what shouldn't because they don't have access to enough of the facts, and we shouldn't put them in the role of being the private decision makers who are under legal compulsion because they will over-censor and there'll be a chilling effect. And then you also sometimes see, I think Eric Goldman is the one who says this most directly, that it's actually just an exceptionalist piece of subsidy to the intermediaries, saying we want more internet intermediaries, so we're going to give them this freedom from liability as a kind of economic boost. And I guess how you feel about where it should go depends upon which of these justifications you believe in. If you believe in what I was just saying about automated reasoning becoming easier, the we didn't know and we could have had no way of knowing point becomes weaker as your computer systems get better. And I think we're seeing this in the copyright arena, where Google was saying actually just yesterday, hey, we're going to take stronger efforts to help out copyright owners and be responsive when they tell us this stuff that you're linking to or hosting on YouTube is infringing. One wonders how far down the road it will be before you start to have this notice and takedown procedure for the defamation and anything that has the same phrases you've already told me are defamatory.
Yeah, I mean, is it really reasonable to expect that we could develop semantic technologies anytime in the foreseeable future that would be able to, notice that there's bad stuff going through the system? With copyright, it's easy. You know, you assign a hash value to a piece of content, and you can match that against everything else. But I mean, just think of the nuanced logic and reasoning that has to go. How do you develop an algorithm that can tell whether something is merely an opinion or subject to a reasonable, non-defamatory interpretation?
So I don't think you could do that. But I think you could have a system that says, I believe this blog post is defamatory to me. And then you would be able to find anyone who is mirroring that blog post. So anyone who simply copied the entire text of it, you would detect in the same way you detect this video is the same one as the one that was uploaded before that infringes my copyright. So you can't get it all right, but you could have better tools than we have today.
And those definitely seem to be necessary. I mean, when we think about Section 230, it was enacted, what, in 1996? Mm-hmm. That was the world of, Prodigy, AOL, and CompuServe. If you look at the legislative history of it and the commentary surrounding it, it was, they were talking about just this massive amount of data going through the Internet at that time. Well, I mean, if you are a singularitarian and, see the exponential growth of data and Just imagine how astronomically more of a concern that is. And
I think they were talking about hundreds of kilobytes.
Oh, my, yes.
Scale problem.
Right.
Right.
This GIF is really breaking my system. It's animated.
Especially when it flashes.
Yeah. The little mailbox that opens.
It's too bad we can't have David Ladd on our panel to say, well, as an intermediary, right, as someone who wrestles with, right? So I know I'm not allowed to call on you, I promise. I won't be a professor and say, okay, so David.
But David's,
this is your life.
David's both an intermediary sometimes and a content creator at other times. Yeah. So he wears both hats.
Yeah. Well, and what maybe this is would be an interesting point to talk about the sort of the free speech versus anonymity, free speech, unmasking tension to the extent it's there. And if we make more robust the unmasking possibility, do we really risk chilling speech in a way that's unacceptable? Almost everyone today has said, if I have to pick, I pick free speech.
Right.
And I wonder is this panel going to continue? Do we have such a dichotomy? And is everyone going to also pick free speech again if the dichotomy is there? I think Evan...
And we raised our hands. I feel like everyone right here was like, free speech, so we have to own it now. Right? We can't backtrack.
My perspective is go ahead and be all pro free speech and all that stuff, because it's probably not going to matter in the end, seeing how most of these cases actually turn out. I've represented a number of John Does who, they get an email from Yelp saying, we've gotten a subpoena from, it's usually Dr. So-and-so, who's angry about something you've said about the services you got at his or her office. And this is speech that is not the kind of stuff that you think about as being, the most protected under the First Amendment. It's not like Publius penning the Federalist Papers. It's that, my tooth hurts real bad, and the care I received, was bad. The doctor committed malpractice. They don't ever talk about the standard of care on Yelp, but, that's where the defamation part gets into it. So, why not just leave it as it is, recognizing there's a First Amendment interest here that's very important, that one needs to see how that, how the dust is going to settle when that runs head-to-head with the right of the plaintiff, the interest of the plaintiff to seek redress against his or her private interests. Because most of the times, and I think the Ninth Circuit has suggested this to us in that recent case involving the company that used to be called Amway, I think it's called Amway, that was a quick start case just in the last couple of months, fine, go ahead and do this First Amendment analysis, recognize the First Amendment interest, but it's mostly going to be commercial speech anyway. Most of the cases that come across my desk involve commercial speech, which would not be entitled to all that much protection. Compared to political speech, like what we saw in the Cahill case, that was probably in your article in 2005.
Picking up on what Evan just said, does everybody here realize what a big threat litigious doctors are to free speech? that there are doctors now who are presenting their patients with contracts to sign that prospectively assign to the doctor the copyright in any review the patient writes of the doctor, so the doctor can then take the contract, show it to a third-party intermediary, like Yelp or one of the other places, and say, I own the copyright, DMCA, take this down.
Only for 35 years, though, because then it could be assigned back. 35 years from now, you can say all you want about it.
Only 35.
Isn't that what it is?
That's the termination.
Reverse back,
But in some sense, it says so much about us that we privilege copyrights. You have doctors going to these great lengths to insist that what they're doing is copyright protected, when in fact, lies that question their expertise and care, which may indeed be lies, so let's not, overlook the fact that we may actually have defamation and ruining people's careers, that we have to look to copyright law, right, to so protect people from defamation just seems downright bizarre. We have something wrong in this calculus. And maybe we don't have to be so afraid that we can't have our cake and eat it too, that we can't have free speech and privacy or freedom from harassment and defamation, that we can make a set of sophisticated judgments about what is harassment, a true threat, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and really what's not. I guess I'm more, and Helen Norton is in the audience, who'd say I'm ever optimistic and that it's true, but I think we can make a set of judgments.
It's also worth noting that it's not always a case of free speech as against privacy. particularly in the context of harassment cases, those are cases that you've written about, Danielle, there are free speech interests on both sides. Because what happens if you allow the anonymous harassers to remain anonymous and keep targeting someone is the target stops speaking. So their First Amendment rights are also implicated. And sort of on a broader scale, if they're targeting someone because of the way they look, if the target is a woman, then what also happens is that people who look like that person or people who identify with that person tend to speak less. And so it can be tricky when you say free speech against privacy because there are free speech interests on both sides. And maybe one set of free speech interests wins out over the other, and they do in all cases, but you're balancing potential chilling on both sides of the equation. So you really need to think about that sometimes.
Well, and a lot of the problem, it seems to me, arises because the chilling may not come. It's not a plaintiff versus a defendant that's necessarily causing the problem. I mean, they're causing the underlying problems, but there's the intermediary in between. And much of the debate has to do with whether intermediaries are going to begin chilling speech. And I think that's a lot of the debate. And so the questions might be directed at and this is where I think a lot of your work goes, is toward the responsibilities of the intermediaries. We haven't talked about, are those things, we assume, there's some defamation and some bad stuff happening out there and a lot of stuff that we think, even if we don't like it, it should be okay. And so we might say, let's not change the law, but can we work on changing the norms about either what intermediaries do or what people do online so we don't have to worry so much about the intermediaries. And is there more hope there than in law? I mean, is it too difficult to draw the legal lines? Where does that complex balancing come in?
Ready? I have a slightly optimistic message about intermediaries.
Right, okay.
At least in the zone of hate speech, that we see really popular intermediaries like Facebook and MySpace working hard at addressing forms of rate, like having hate speech policies, though they're not doing a perfect job of it, having their community report instances of hate speech that's destructive and making a set of decisions about whether to take it down. Now, that doesn't mean they're doing a terrific job or that they're bringing great nuance in how they understand hate speech, and they're not very transparent in what they mean by that, but they are at least taking steps to recognizing that they're creating communities of citizens and individuals who are engaged in discourse, and at least trying. So that's a very subdued optimism, I think.
There's another piece of this on the law as it tries to regulate the norms of intermediary side that gets us even deeper into my head hurts waters, which is the 230C2 aspect of it, which is these intermediaries who go out there and in good faith are trying to make calls about what to let through and what not to. They're like the Google that's trying not to link to the guy whose business model is get bad reviews, so he goes up in Google. You've got YouTube trying to pull down things that are actually offensive to their audience. And the question of, at some point, does the intermediary start to wrong the individuals when it targets you in that way and takes you down, even though what you were saying was innocent, but you had enemies who flagged it as hate speech? Or are they taking down legitimate merchants who have been victims of smear campaigns by their opponents? You get into a very hard question about what the most responsible thing to do is and how light or heavy a touch law should have in controlling it.
I just really think we've got to keep our hands off the intermediaries and putting extra burdens on them if we care anything at all about innovation and the development of the infrastructure and seeing startups succeed. I mean, companies who are wanting to do things on the web, the great innovation comes from being able to focus on that and not being, mired down in all of these very subjective and burdensome things. So, I mean, I would really lament any change in any of this that puts an extra burden on the intermediary, because that does, just because we're keeping them out of it, which we recognize as a good policy decision 15 years ago, just because we're keeping them out of it doesn't mean that there's not redress for the injured plaintiff.
And where do you see the redress happening? I mean, if it's not through the intermediaries, then how is that?
Well, we need the intermediaries' cooperation. So that's why I, would think that a reasonable person would have time to listen to what you suggested, Danielle, about some kind of immunity conditioned on them retaining data, because that should be relatively simple, you know, putting a, you know, issuing a litigation hold, so to speak, on, you know, a certain data set if you get notice. But, you know, I mean, even that, you know, should really be, there should really be a lot of leniency there, because it is really hard to operate a web business. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on, especially if you're successful and you've got millions of users. You know, you're not, we're not going to see a vibrant development of the internet infrastructure if there's this constant risk and an actual liability placed on companies for not having 500 lawyers in their legal department reviewing, you know, these abuse reports. It's a tough one.
Right, well, retaining huge amounts of data causes all kinds of other problems as well, right? And Danielle's suggestion about sort of companies proactively going out and trying to restrain or deal with hate speech in non-legal ways, but in a more sort of norms-based way, also tends to put more responsibility on the intermediaries. That is, they may lose their immunity under CBA, under Section 230, if they go too far in that way in terms of creating content, mm-hmm. right, and taking steps. And so I do think this is a significant problem, which is what incentives we give both to businesses to start and to be able to continue, and then their incentives to be good citizens in the world. And now I fear we have raised more questions ultimately than we have answered on the panel, but maybe it's a good time to open it up to the audience. With questions, and I understand I have to call on a student first, but I don't know any students.
There are fewer now.
Right. Friday afternoon is difficult.
It is Friday.
Well, we were talking about, is there the lunch break place where the newspaper and on our online site, we would see you would have commenting, and sometimes we would turn the commenting off. We would look for stories that were going to get a lot of comments, but then if it was sensational or something, we didn't have the manpower to monitor those comments, we would actually turn the commenting off on that. And I don't know, I'm not familiar with Section 230, but how does that apply to newspaper sites, and would the paper have been liable?
So I'm going to restate the question so that everyone can hear it. Hopefully I'll restate it correctly. But the question is about how Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act might apply to a newspaper, and in particular to comments. So that not this is content provided not by the newspaper itself, but by readers of the newspaper, and how Section 230 affects that. And I don't know, Danielle, you want to.
I was going to say Evan.
Evan.
Evan's talking too much.
Oh. No. Yeah. Well, I mean, Section 230 provides protection for any user or provider of an interactive computer service. And so I think that the way this would shake out, and I don't know of any cases where, like, an old media print publication has been called to the mat for its
online
component.
Yeah. Oh.
Right. No, for,
right.
Like, the New York Times website, for example. But, I mean, the way it should shake out is that the secondary liability analysis would actually be different for the web property than what it would for the paper. The immunity, and I come from the Seventh Circuit, so I have a hard time calling it immunity, because Judge Easterbrook on the Seventh Circuit will not let us call it immunity.
What does he have it called exactly?
Well, he looks to Section C1. This will get wonky for a second. He looks to C1 as being merely definitional, saying, you know, the provider or user language. But then C2 is really where the protection is if you are a good Samaritan. It's called the Good Samaritan provision, after all. It's the Doe versus GTE case from 2003.
So what are the magic words that you use? Yeah. Good Samaritan protection.
Safe
harbor.
Now we just...
you don't say immunity, obviously.
Right, don't say immunity. Like, we just say Craigslist. So, I mean, I think that secondary liability analysis would be different for the web property than it would, say, you know, a letter to the editor, which is user-generated content, but printed on paper. It would be different because it doesn't fall into that 230C1 definition of user or provider of an interactive computer service. Well, there would be that they could either raise it as an affirmative, it depends on where you are, how you want to do it procedurally, whether you want to raise 230 as an affirmative defense or file a 12B6 motion or judgment motion for judgment on the pleadings or whatever. But, yeah, it would trigger that immunity.
Yeah. No liability.
I said it. Right. Yeah.
Right, no liability.
So right there.
Hi. I'm an alumnus of the soon-to-be defunct School of Journalism here. And the topic sort of goes up. We studied many, many years ago, and I'm doing my degree. The difference between freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and that is a huge difference. I think we've kind of been in this discussion, and I really appreciate all your comments. There's some really wonderful things that have come up that have confused us. Freedom of speech in 1700s was a person standing up, not anonymously, but recognizably in a town hall and discussing things that matter to the public. And I brought something up in the last discussion, and this is law is now being looked at very carefully in the states of Massachusetts and New England, where I come from, of online bullying. People have, there's been suicide, there's been bankruptcies, there's been also something that professor once told me at Harvard, I attended some lectures there, he was rather, you know, so it's a colorful phrase, question, why does a dog lay his balls? Because he can. And why do corporations get away with the outrageous amount of public, personal investigations of every single person who gets online for your financial needs? Right now, I'm a criminal investigator, forensic specialist, working mostly in homicides in Los Angeles. And I worked on a case recently. This wasn't a homicide. I'll do this as quickly as I can. For one of the largest blood analyzation places, if not the largest in the United States, Quest, out of Arizona, was intimidating all of its customers by sending felonious bills, okay, with incorrect information, basically threatening collection that they were going to go through the three major credit unions. In this investigation, I found out that the credit agencies who use all this online information each one has a division selling your personal financial information. And every time one of those people who buys your credit information searches on the credit, your credit score goes down. And I'm seeing a little sort of Piranha-ish predatory situation going on here. So for all the wonderful fun we have on Facebook, I think it's time possibly for us to start looking at who is really benefiting from this plethora of information that we are so freely giving out, and that the laws of the press and what the press does are should be done by trained specialists. Not by people who are just having a hobby, shooting their mouths off about their neighbor. I hope I might be too didactic here, but I think there's going to be a huge exigency coming right now. And again, you've talked about it, and I really appreciate you bringing it up. But I think the American public is about to wake up and find out that someone's selling their underwear. They're the ones freely putting it out on the marketplace. Thank you. Pardon me if I'm being a little over the top.
So I'm not going to try to restate your statement, but I think one point you raised that's really interesting is that, and this is the value, as Paul said, of bringing a lot of different people together, is that I don't mean to point fingers at anybody in particular. I might use the term free speech in a way that, you know, a First Amendment scholar is going to die, mm-hmm. Roll over in the ways that maybe sometimes we use that when we're, you know, people from other fields talking about that. And I think it's an important, that may be something to think about, is what are we talking about when we're talking about free speech? And Nathaniel pointed out, well, it's often we have speech interests on more than one side. So I think that's one issue worth being careful about and what we care about. And then something I've often thought is interesting, and I don't know anything about it, so maybe there are people can talk about it, is there's we have free speech values, but what is the value in particular of anonymous speech? And is that different? Is it more important? Is it less important? And so how do we think about anonymity itself as a value versus speech as a value? So I don't know if that's enough of a question to...
It's a tough subject matter. I'm just saying what we're dealing with here is an extremely touchy issue.
Yes.
I've been a victim of bullying at a jury, and I've been involved in the case of a lot of teenagers committing suicide over bullying. And, you know, everybody thinks this freedom of speech is great until they get picked up and kind of get excoriated in their life. And let me ask just one quick thing. Anyone lately who has tried to book an attorney to sue someone, start writing a five-figure check. And why should I, if where are my civil rights bids, that I should have to go out and write a $10,000 to $30,000 check for being the victim of having myself being shredded online?
So
the government protection from the private citizen, and I deal with people who had to deal with tearing their families apart. Pardon me, I'm being a little emotional here, but it's a really intense subject. I think we should cover it.
Absolutely.
Just a couple of things that came out of what you're talking about. One of the issues that you mentioned is these credit agencies who sell personal information, and a lot of corporations that deal in personal information have used free speech arguments to defend it.
Right.
So you have, fortunately, there's also pressures against it. Cases out of the First Circuit in which state laws preventing drug companies from buying up prescription information have been upheld, even though the companies tried to say, oh, this is First Amendment protected speech because we're talking about matters of public importance. And the other thing I would say is that anonymity is really tied today to the distribution of power in society. That one of the reasons a lot of people feel the need to be anonymous is because they're afraid of what powerful enemies could do to them if they were identified. This is the whistleblower problem. And you can't sort of look at that problem in a vacuum from who can do what to whom if they know who they are.
Well, I still go to that original town meeting statement where you could address the President of the United States or the President of your club or but you stood up and you stuck your neck out and you made your statement.
The colonialists saw a real value in anonymity, though, in writing. I mean, I've never had the opportunity to mention Publius in the Federalist Papers twice in one talk.
I mean, we should also mention that, I mean, is it McIntyre versus the Ohio Elections Commission, which found a right to anonymous speech?
Right.
And the degree to which the right is absolute and the degree to which there's some pressure on it is a question, but there is sort of a recognized legal right to anonymity in speaking and the importance of that in the context of Publius and in the, sort of the context of the broader public debate.
And one of the fast.
What happens when you get 25 people ganging up on one person anonymously? What are you going to do about that? Because it's starting to affect us.
I mean, and that's where law has a role to play. And as you said, you know, so well, that to use these legal tools, though, it's incredibly expensive. And so victims are at a great disadvantage because even, right, if you are ganged up on, which is really common, sort of anonymous mobs online targeted an individual with, you know, lies and threats, but you're still at such a disadvantage because it's incredibly expensive to bring a civil suit. And then if you go to the local law enforcement, if it rises to the level of a threat, like an harassment, so often they say, listen, come back if it spills offline. They're just ill-trained to realize it's actually criminal activity. And so victims are in a terrible bind.
Now, if you brought this up, and I'll finish here, I've been asked to join the Los Angeles Gang Board over six. In LA, you wear colors, you're in a neighborhood, you're Hispanic, there are laws about assembly. We have gone in the state, the state where the criminal justice system is the seventh largest economy in the world, just the criminal justice, to being able to round up bunches of kids and throw them in jail. Or being seen with similar types of cases. So if we're willing to go there for gang-oriented behavior, how can we not protect an individual through the government? Not, I'm saying, why can't we protect the individual from being harassed, threatened, and et cetera, by gangs of people online?
If you want to respond to that, you should respond to Paul. One thing that I was going to mention, I think when we talk about this, we talk a lot about sort of how can we respond, thinking about ways to move forward, where do we want to go, what are good next steps. And I just wanted to throw out that one thing I think would be extremely useful is if we looked more towards some other countries, particularly some countries in Asia, that have been dealing with this. I just returned from living in Korea for a year. And I can tell you that whatever sort of the online harassment problems that we're dealing with here are remarkably small in comparison to the scope that they have faced in South Korea. They had, among other things, one of a former president committed suicide as a result of, among other things, online harassment. So this rash, and they have it's something like 99% broadband penetration. Everyone has wire. Everyone has mobile phones with incredibly fast internet connections. The 2008 elections that were this massive internet-powered election here, 2002 was the election year in Korea where the internet completely transformed their elections. So in some ways, the challenges that we're trying to deal with, they have been wading through for a half decade. And while we may not like some of the solutions they've came up with, among other things, in Korea right now, there is no anonymous online commenting. In order to comment on the internet, you need to give effectively your social security number. And needless to say, this has some non-trivial privacy implications. But what's interesting is that this is a community, and it's a democracy, and it's a vibrant democracy, where this is where they've been trying to solve these problems for 5 and 6 years. And it's a real opportunity to get some data, to actually try to evaluate the impact and to see what's happened and to try to learn from that. There are obviously many differences, but there I think there's some opportunities to see other solutions, and it's, among other things, this real ID law in Korea is under a lot of fire right now, and it might be about to be repealed. So among other things, it's just maybe that isn't the way to go, but it's just a useful place to look.
Go ahead.
So my question sort of dovetails exactly with what you said. There isn't a publication in the U.S. today that isn't struggling with this idea of anonymous comments versus asking people to register. And it's a back and forth kind of a thing. And right now my site, I'm a journalist, so right now my site doesn't have people, you can post anonymously. And I'm trying to get people, you know, I'm trying to get the registration system in place. But somebody said something on this panel that might not be a good idea. I mean, could we wind up getting ourselves in the middle of lawsuits and now we're being sued to get to turn over the names of the people who are registering? This and that. I mean, right now, if you came to us, we'd say, well, we don't know.
Right.
And we delete the comments that are harassing. We don't post that thing. It's just common sense. But is it somehow better for us to stay anonymous in some way?
Well, you wouldn't lose any sort of immunity or protection you'd have. The difference would be only that if someone served you with a subpoena, which they could do in either case, instead of saying, we don't know, you would potentially need to respond with the information. I'm not sure that one is more burdensome than the other necessarily, and you wouldn't lose any protection you would have.
So the binary question is not right. Whether or not you permit anonymity, it's right. Just whether you allow comments or not. Because right. Even if you allow anonymous... Regardless of whether you require authentication and, you know, exact identification, you would still get the same subpoena requesting the same information, which is an IP address and a MAC address, if that's impossible. And that's really what's going to be useful for the next round of discovery.
Paul?
So I have two questions. I just want to follow up, and I'm going to do so revealing my ignorance to 30, but I think it might be confusing people. What I mean, at the very end, she said, and I removed the harassing stuff. And I think it was the Reuters decided that they would remove all uncivil speech. I mean, are you more worried about their 230 immunities in these cases? And then my other question, though, is for James, which was you talked a lot about automated reasoning exacerbating the problems and also enabling the benefits of first-class objects. But automated reasoning is also going to make first-class objects a lot less important, isn't it? So Google takes everything about me and makes some automated reasoning guesses and reduces it probably to some internal UID. And they're pretty good at it, I'm guessing, partly because my name is a little bit unusual, but they're pretty good at it. And my guess is they're only gonna get better and better and better over time, where they're gonna be really accurate about plucking me out of that pool, whether or not there's a first-class object assigned to me. And so maybe this is just a temporary way station, and in 10 years it's gonna seem odd to consider first-class objects that much more of a frictionless place than just my name, which is already going to be pretty frictionless. I don't know what you think about that.
So let me take on your second half of the question. If Google has assigned you a UID, a universal or unique identifier, then I think that you would be a first-class object in their system, according to my definition.
No, but I mean, even when I'm not logged in, even when I'm not, you know, just by looking at my behavior and my traffic, they're going to also assign me to that.
Your use as a searcher?
Yeah,
or
sure, or as anything. I mean, whatever it is, they're going to be better at it 10 years from now than they are today. right? Yeah. The behavioral stuff, the re-identification stuff that I've been writing about. It just seems like this may become less of a distinction.
Right. This gets us into territory that you've mined with your re-identification paper, yeah, which is, what do you do about the system that knows everything about Paul Ohm but doesn't put the last piece of the puzzle into place, the actual name linking to a person? Just like, user 67432 has done all of these things, and any person who looked at this thing closely at all would figure out it has to be you. And they just don't make that final link, and they say, it's not personal. And then, of course, Paul has written this wonderful literature survey paper explaining to the legal world that computer scientists have shown that that's not anonymous at all. That people in the legal community are accustomed to thinking that if you just delete the last information, delete the first 5 digits of the Social Security number, it's anonymous now. When in fact, somebody with access to that database and a few others can very easily re-identify everybody in it. And this undercuts one of the assumptions a lot of policymakers have made about how to make databases safe for ordinary use.
And I don't want to belabor it, but let me just add my one example, which is I fully believe in 10 years, Google, if it's still the leader, will say, oh, you're a person who types your double O's with about 1.2 milliseconds between them, and you tend to use commas with single spaces and period. You're Paul Ohm. Okay, and they're going
to. Would you like to buy this?
And at that point, I think the fact that I'm a first-class object or not is almost irrelevant, or a lot less relevant.
I think this goes to Evan's point about how do you draw the line. Yeah. At what point are they able to reason about you? Mm-hmm. And it's not a clear binary.
I would also say it doesn't sound to me like in this vision, the data record that represents Paul Ohm, it still is a first-class object. I mean, I don't think that gets... I think you're absolutely right, but I don't think it gets you out of James's reasoning. I think whether...
it's a first-class object, maybe is what I'm saying.
Well, maybe you move towards that, but what the upshot is you're moving towards more more structured data, more accessible data, more integrated data.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a first-class object that just doesn't have a field that says Paul Ohm. Right. In all other respects, it is him.
Oh, I don't know. How about in the very back? Right, I'm sorry, I don't even...
So just to follow that point, I wonder, is there the possibility of re-identifying anonymous speech provides some kind of accountability to anonymous speech that might not have been there before?
Oh, that'd be quite interesting to think if that could be part of discovery.
So I have to say that this is not automatic, but in the course of researching a paper that I'm working on right now, I've been looking through some Wikipedia edit histories, and I've seen some pretty fierce arguments there. And I've only been able to find this one person who uses a four-letter Wikipedia username, but I am very confident that I know who this person is by full name, just because the writing style in their arguments telling the other Wikipedians, you're an idiot because, are exactly like the arguments on a particular website that says, hey, you other guy, you're an idiot because.
I mean, one factor here, though, is that re-identification relies on a large amount of data, a mass of data. And so it, in order for that to be useful to identify an anonymous harasser or an anonymous speaker of any kind, it requires them to have spoken a lot, or it requires them to be integrated with other kinds of data. And so maybe this will become, to the extent that we have first-class objects floating over our heads in 10 years, it might become more and more effective. But if all you're working from is a few comments, it can be incredibly difficult.
David?
I was really intrigued by Anne's remarks about what's going on in South Korea, and it sort of ties in also to the last couple of questions. I'm curious about what the panelists think about a system like South Korea, where you can argue about what standard, a la John Doe subpoenas, you know, you get the key to unlock it, but what about a system where, not just for online commenting, but all of our web behavior, shopping on Amazon, looking at dating websites, whatever, it can be known to a certainty, maybe with a thumbprint, so you can't even say, oh, that was my roommate's computer, that they can know for a certainty you are this person. Like, would you guys be in favor of a system where somebody, government, Big Brother, Janet Napolitano, I don't know who, has that kind of key, and kind of what James was saying about the Eric Schmidt 2 database, if somebody can unlock that key, maybe there's a very high showing, a la John Doe subpoena, but would you guys be in favor of that, or no?
No, because I don't trust the government.
Yeah. I don't think I would be in favor. I mean, you're a smart guy, so I suppose you have a countervailing.
Oh, no, I'm not in favor something. Of it. I'm a blog okay. publisher.
Well, yeah. Right, right.
I'm just curious.
I mean, I guess the only place
I'm nervous about Section 230 is my best friend.
Yeah, I mean, the only place I would trust it is in the Ministry of Information. Isn't that what Orwell called that big building that had the memory hole and all that stuff?
No. I'm afraid to answer this one because I've written that about traceable anonymity. And as Paul said, that it was like throwing napalm at, I can't even, what was that line, Paul, that you were like, don't do it, it could be misused. But I mean, you think about traceable anonymity, some of the sort of trade-off between allowing immunity for intermediaries is that the argument, well, you can go after the perpetrators, right? But if we can't go after the perpetrators, then it's lawless. And this isn't lawless, right, this zone. It has powerful effects offline life for individuals. And so for me, in thinking it through, if we're not going to go after intermediaries, then we have to provide we have to slow down the perpetrators in some way. And so I think traceable anonymity with a very powerful key is one way to do it.
I mean, whether you like it or not, I think one interesting thing, if you look at the case of South Korea, is the consequences of it. What's happened is that you've started, there's been, they actually have this term which they call digital refugees, which basically means Korean citizens who use non-Korean web services. And it's very funny. So YouTube.
That is so interesting.
YouTube was the fourth most popular out of four major video sharing services in South Korea. And after this law was passed, Google concluded that what they were going to do was close their YouTube offices in Korea and redirect everyone to YouTube in another country and say, we no longer fall under the jurisdiction of your Real ID law, so we don't need to comply. And the upshot of this is that YouTube, which was the fourth most popular video sharing site, is now the most popular video sharing site. So I think there's a question of the practicality of it, short of some sort of broader enforcement scheme.
It sounds a lot like what you said about, what we've talked about, the unintended consequences of laws, right? Creating people better at anonymizing or going offshore in various ways.
Right.
In the middle of
that. But is there really any such thing as being anonymous as the web evolves and changes and will become more of a semantic web with artificial intelligence and aggregation coming together? And we're seeing that moving faster, like Foursquare will tell you, physically where somebody is standing based on their cell phone. So are we moving away from the ability to be anonymous anyway?
I think the challenge with that, and the key there, is whether you're talking about, in theory, are we moving away from it, and where we are today. And I think they're very different. But in particular, especially in a civil context, if someone wants to remain anonymous for a set of actions online, it's still remarkably easy for them to do. And maybe you're right, in your life, if you choose to use all these tools and you choose to connect in all these ways and you let all these things link together, it becomes harder and harder. But regardless, if you're thinking of anonymously harassing person X and you want to do it anonymously and you are technically savvy, it can be done.
Yeah, what you're suggesting is something that could be analogized to resolution. All these data points are creating a very fine resolution picture of where you are and what you're doing, who you are and all that stuff. But I don't see any reason why that same capability to paint or to generate, to render a high resolution image of who you are and where you are and what you're doing and who you're with and all that stuff couldn't be used to be pseudonymous. What's that word?
Pseudonymous.
Yeah. To be someone else and somewhere else. I mean, there's just, it's a hack that's probably already been fixed now, but where somehow you can game Foursquare with the BlackBerry to say that you're in Europe right now. Why not use those tools to paint just a different picture, because it's all a question of resolution.
It's sort of
the aggregators are not in cahoots with each other.
Smarter than the user.
You have a Google aggregator and you have a different aggregator out there. And unless you're seriously technically savvy and maintaining a harasser profile and a non-harasser profile, the chances of keeping that clean and segregated gets reduced as you become more and more technologically connected, mm-hmm. no matter what your tool is.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think we maybe have time for one more question. Neil?
So I guess one solution to the John Noble, and I think some websites move towards it, is to use not a government authenticator, Anthony, but to use a private sector one. So I've started to see sites where you can log in using Facebook. And that doesn't avoid the subpoena problem. Well, it avoids the John Doe subpoena problem. It makes then any future subpoenas to identify the purpose of evidence directed to Facebook rather than the commenting site. But I wonder if there's not two problems with that. One is there is this enormous chill of valuable anonymous speech as well as harassing, defamatory, nasty, racist, hateful, bad speech. But putting that free speech interest, which there is no countervailing free speech interest on the other side, to one side, we then get ourselves back into the problems of panel one, I think we're on panel three. We solve the anonymity harassing problem to some extent, but then we just create additional privacy problems by linking all of these comments to already established real person profile, the architectural choice of a single identity, which was the, for whatever reason, that was the norm in the early internet. Because of the Zadie Smith Center for the social network, the personality works, that's not a word, designing Facebook, architecture is doing some work, but it's not more neutral. And so I'm not sure it can be any better off under that system.
That may be a good place to end there as sort of the transition from through us to the next panel. So let's end there, and I think you do get a break now.